You're listening to By the Well, a podcast for preachers where we discuss the Bible to help you preach in your contexts. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And this week it's Easter 4. We're looking at John 10, verses 1 to 10, Psalm 23, Acts 2, 42 to 47, and of course 1 Peter 2, 19 to 25. This week is traditionally known as Good Shepherd Sunday, so we will be spending some time looking at the shepherd imagery in those readings before we get to more detail about Peter.
And helping us in our discussion today, we have a special guest, Mike Bird. Mike is the academic dean at Ridley College here in Melbourne and a lecturer in theology there. Mike writes prolifically and puts the rest of us to shame. He's written over 30 books, the most recent being, and perhaps one of the most well-known already, being The New Testament in Its World, which came out in 2019, co-authored with Tom Wright. Welcome, Mike.
Oh, thank you, Robin. Thank you, Fran, for having me.
Oh, thank you for being with us. First, Mike, I'm wondering if I can ask you a general question. I don't know how often you've had occasion to preach, but just wondering what your approach usually is to the texts when you do.
Well, I get to ask to preach a little bit about once every 6 weeks on average. Here and there. It depends on certain times of year. Usually around holiday season when ministers are going on leave.
Exactly.
seems to be the main time I seem to go get these invitations. What I usually start off doing is thinking about who are the congregation that I'll be talking to. Which part of Melbourne are they? What's the makeup of the congregation? I then go over and prayerfully look over the text, have a few different reads of it, and then start having to think, you know, how am I going to unpack this? How am I going to move from, you know, first century Corinth to 21st century Werribee? Or how am I going to address these people at this Christian camp, or whether it's a youth group, or if it's an event in a nursing home? What can I take away? And, you know, at one level, you can read the text, read a couple of commentaries. Simply knowing the main points or any disputed things is quite easily. The real hard part is how to make people excited about the text, how to get them interested into it and persuade them. And I think that's what preaching really is, really persuade them as to how this text speaks to them or has something to say to them and can, you know, change their perspectives, their habits, or whatever it is, and in their daily lives or their relationship with God.
Yeah,
fantastic. And, I mean, the texts today are so rich, so we're not going to be able to do them all justice.
No.
We will reserve some time towards the end to make sure we do get into that 1 Peter 2 text, since we're focusing on that a bit in this series. But let's start with the others. We've got this utopian vision in Acts 2 of this early church breaking bread, going to temple together, sharing everything, like being in community that seems amazingly harmonious.
Just like the real world.
Just like us today. We've got John 10, this, you know, well-known, beautiful passage about Jesus as the good shepherd and the gate who comes to bring life. And, of course, Psalm 23 is the background to some of that. Mike, what strikes you about these readings and what do you think, you know, what emerges for you as things we should know about them and might preach from them?
Oh, I think a number of things. I think these are three very good, elegant texts, or four elegant texts we have there. Acts 2, if you like, is pretty good because, again, it is that idealized account of the church. I mean, everyone's eager to hear teaching. They want fellowship. They're worshiping, shared meals, shared possessions. There's prayer. There's signs and wonders.
Yeah.
And probably the best verse at the moment is verse 46. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts. I wouldn't mind doing something a bit of that now, rather than just me cooking about my three meals I know how to cook and ordering Uber Eats with the same people every night.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having a few friends or a few students over for a meal sometime, but I don't think I'll be doing that until much later in the year. But Acts is a good text about being invested in each other's lives and being in Eucharistic and even economic interconnection with the people of your church.
Yeah, and it's often dismissed as, I used the word utopian before, I think, and I think sometimes we go, oh, this is too idealized. And that can be a way to actually not take it seriously, perhaps.
And it occurs to me just now too, in the situation we're all in, where we're isolated and resources will be very stretched in the churches, that this is something we can actually strive for, that is the sharing of possessions. What does that mean? when a city church is going to be probably okay financially, yeah, but a country one may not be. And how do we
support each other's ministries?
I know in the US they're doing a sponsorship thing already through the COVID-19. Mm. Anyway. So,
But it can be more real than that. You know, if you're asking a church, okay, who here has got a spare laptop or a spare iPad? I mean, I'm trying to homeschool kids, and yesterday one of our laptops died, yeah, so we had to quickly repurpose an iPad into a learning device for a child. And it's like, oh, I need a maths tutor. Any retired maths teachers, yeah, here or anything? You end up with people able to help you. Someone does have a spare laptop. Someone is a retired teacher who knows maths.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, that's. Can we turn our attention to John, and with it the echo of the psalm? Because it strikes me that we could do a lot worse during these difficult times than reflecting and reading Psalm 23, which is already such a precious text to so many people. This sense of God with us in the dark valley, and that, you know, offering us a feast even in the presence of enemies. The sense of the abundance and mercy of God even in the presence of hardship and suffering.
Exactly. Well, I mean, John 10 is one of the classic passages in the New Testament, which is, you know, so hard, so hard to forget. I mean, you know, I am the good shepherd. You know, I lay down my life for the sheep. It really is a classic text that even people who may not be familiar with the Bible or the church will probably know something about. I rather like the sort of the echoes of the intertext behind it, Psalm 23, which is a very nice, famous text, "The Lord is my shepherd." One of the most intriguing ways I came across for reading Psalm 23 comes from an Old Testament scholar called Doug Green. Mm. And he says, to read Psalm 23 messianically is not to imagine Jesus as your shepherd, but rather imagine Jesus as the one who himself prays the prayer. Mm. He is the one who goes through the valley of the shadow of the death. He is the one who wants to be vindicated, who looks for life, who feels the despair. So you can almost imagine Jesus in Gethsemane praying a prayer like that.
Oh, or indeed that one.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I think is a far more, in terms of how the early church read their scriptures, you know, thinking more of the Messiah as the one praying these psalms, like Psalm 22 and Psalm 2 and others. Mm. So rather than the standard Jesus is my shepherd, imagine Jesus as himself as the one praying in that psalm, going through the valley of the shadow of death, or as we would say in John 10, the one who is laying down his life for the sheep. Mm.
That's such a helpful way to think about that too, because it immediately ties, and we'll get there in a moment, to the First Peter passage, which again talks of the suffering servant and is probably drawing on Isaiah 53 and one of the well-known suffering servant passages. So there's a link. I mean, there's multiple links in the lectionary this week.
Well, even the mention of enemies in this psalm. I mean, the word enemies is not mentioned explicitly in the 1 Peter, but one would assume if you're being abused wrongly.
Yeah.
There's hostility there that could otherise be called, enemy presence.
But I like that, because we go very quickly to Jesus as shepherd, but in fact there's something very profound about reading it in the way you're suggesting there, Mike.
Also, that does get away a bit from the problem where, for us, shepherds are not a hugely meaningful symbol.
No, for those of us who aren't farmers.
Yeah.
Or live in modern cities.
Yeah, so it's really helpful to think of it that other way.
I also, I do love in this John passage, it's probably one of my favourite Bible verses, the John 10:10, I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. And I think there's a link there to the Psalm 23 as well, with this abundant feasting. There's something about what the abundance, the abundant mercy of God. And, of course, in an ancient world, I mean, today we think of abundance as having a smart car and a beach house and lots of gadgets and, you know, financial stability. But in the ancient world, abundance, you know, was almost came to its peak in the ability to feast when you had a good harvest. Mm-hmm. That was the big sign of kind of God's blessing. And, you know, right now, again, while we're isolated and perhaps unable to feast in the ways we might like to, go out to restaurants and gather friends.
Offer hospitality too.
I think that feasting, and I mean, I don't want to go there, but huge debates happening in churches about virtual communion and what it means to fast or feast. Mm. You know, there's lots of things one could play with there.
Definitely, yep.
Yeah, indeed.
Mike, shall we turn our attention to this First Peter passage, which the lectionary has starting in 219, but really the flow of it starts in 218 with a difficult verse, I think.
Yes.
Let slaves obey their masters with all respect, not only the good and kind ones, but also the unkind ones. I'll admit up front, I've struggled with this passage. It's the kind of thing in the Bible that I want to just ignore. But when I sit with it, there's some wisdom here. But I think we have to do work to find it. Yeah. So what would you say, or what would you want to point out to give some context and help us unpack what's going on here?
Yeah, well, the first thing we've got to remember is when we read this, we are struck, as you point out, because, you know, it's acknowledging the practice of slavery, and we would much prefer if Peter or Paul and the early church were more like a modern William Wilberforce or a Martin Luther King who are announcing the day of freedom has come to set the captives free, that type of thing. We'd prefer that Paul ended all of his epistles with hashtag end slavery now, hashtag slave lives matter.
He didn't do that. It's not in Corinthians.
No. It's not. We don't get that. Mm-hmm. And this is where they attempt to ameliorate the suffering of slavery. And it's concerning because we would prefer to see an ethic about liberating people from it. But in this context, this part of the letter, what I think Peter is doing is trying to help slaves endure and survive a difficult situation. Mm. And Christ becomes the example as one who is innocent, who suffers unjustly, but he endures. And one of the big things that comes across is not retaliating. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, particularly when you get on a few verses later. And that, I know one African-American scholar, a friend of mine, he takes that as one of the major emphasis, and he actually compares in his book on First Peter two different movies about African Americans. He first of all starts off with The Django Unchained, which is a Quentin Tarantino movie about a slave who gets freed by a German bounty hunter, and then the slave goes on and gets some serious venge. He gets some serious vengeance against the people who took him and his family slave. And then my friend Dennis then talks about another movie, a movie called 42, about the African-American baseball player Jackie Robinson, who became one of the greatest American baseball players, but who endured a lot of racism from fans in the stadium, from coaches, even from fellow players. But kind of he put up with it. He didn't, respond with some of the bitterness and malevolence and resentments. He just took it all in his stride and rose above it and did not allow it. And Dennis says, the problem I have is some people, they want the Django Unchained response. They want some serious vengeance, where someone like Jackie Robinson, he sees as more like a type of Christ figure, someone who endures unrighteous behavior, evil and wickedness, but in not a way that retaliates. And Dennis has also been a pastor in some difficult parts of Chicago, and he knows what the culture of revenge and retaliation leads to. It does not yield peace. It does not lead. You know, if everyone goes an eye for an eye, you end up with a world of cyclopses.
Yes, that's right, and a lot of violence.
Yeah, the violence begets violence. So reading what Dennis Edwards said, it was terrific. He said, you know, we need to be more like Jackie Robinson and less like Django when we are suffering unjustly. Now, I should say as well, the whole thing about, you know, endure suffering can be horribly misused, particularly when you think in context of things like domestic violence. Mm. I would not be using that as a way to counsel any woman, child, or anything about putting up with it. But this is talking to a condition of slaves who are unable, and there is no government authority they can call to come interdict. There is no kind of, Fair Work Association for slaves or anything.
No, there's no rights. There's no sense of human rights for slaves.
Yeah, I know. I mean, slaves are considered furniture with a soul. I mean, to use the language of Aristotle. Mm. So, but thankfully, that's not where he leaves it, and he moves to the example of Christ, who is the one who suffered as an innocent person, but did not retaliate with violence. And Peter says, this is the one whom you should follow. You ought to follow in his footsteps. And one thing I like to stress to my students is simply how significant and important the theme of the imitation of Christ is throughout the New Testament. Whether that's, you know, in the Gospels, whether that's in Paul's letters, whether it's here in 1 Peter or in Hebrews, the theme of the imitation of Christ is absolutely everywhere. I mean, humans are mimetic creatures. We tend to we imitate things, whether we know it or not. I find if I spend a lot of time hanging out with Tom Wright, I keep using the word precisely. I keep saying the word precisely. It's precisely that kind of kingdom vision and precisely that sort of message, which leads to precisely the type of vocation Jesus calls his disciples. But we naturally imitate what we admire. Yes. And Peter calls us to admire and imitate Christ, because he has got the example for us to follow. And then he adds, he is the one who has also suffered and died for us. He has made atonement for our sins.
Mm. So would you go as far as to say that the passage is radical, Mike, in terms of its treatment of slaves?
In many senses, yeah. You can find people in the ancient world trying to ameliorate or mitigate the severity of slavery. You do get people say, look, you know, don't beat your slaves up too bad, that type of thing, which at one level sounds like pretty minimal comfort.
But it is introducing an ethic of a kind, right?
It is an improvement of the situation of slaves, which was deplorable, destitute, and often one with not much hope. Now, of course, the quality of life of slaves, you know, varied quite markedly. Some ex-slaves of the emperor could end up being governors of provinces. Yeah. You know, that kind of a thing. You know, all the way to the more, you know, extreme states of degradation and suffering. But Peter does recognize that this is not an ideal state. I did hear another African American scholar, I can't remember his name, tell me that he I read somewhere along the lines that he understood these statements about slavery, because he said every African American man has to have a talk with his son, and it's not about where babies come from. It's basically how you have to negotiate the world when it's less than ideal.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to teach your son, you know, if you get pulled over by police, this is where you put your hands on the steering wheel, okay? This is the American context. Mm. This is how you address, even if you've done nothing wrong and you were not the car you were speeding or anything. Or if you're walking down the street when it's dark and you see a white woman walking towards you, you cross the street to get to, because if you do anything to make her feel unsafe and she calls the police, it does not end well for you. Mm. So he says that this is sort of advice here. Look, this is not an ideal. This is not a good situation. Mm. But if you're going to survive in it, this is what you have to do to get through it. It's not good. It's not ideal. But this is how you negotiate it.
I must admit, I did think about the African American context and the gospel singing and the joyous survival that comes through in the manner of their worship and their singing and their praise. You know, going back to when they actually were slaves.
Yeah, the gospel tradition.
So, yeah.
And there, I mean, I think survival is an interesting way to think about this passage, because as you were saying, Mike, this is not, Peter here is not advocating for, changing the system. We might want him to.
No.
Some of us might wish he had. But in fact, you know, just before this, he's talked about giving honor to all humans, including the emperor or whoever's in power. He's not about overturning the system. I think he actually is about survival. And there might be a real kindness here, a pragmatism too, but I think perhaps a real mercy here in saying to slaves who are part of Christian communities, when you're in, you know, your capacity as a slave, you will need to do things. You might need to even go to pagan temples. You might need to do things that you know are not what God would have you do, but actually that's okay, because you also need to, you know, kind of obey your master. There's almost permission in doing that to say you don't have to risk your life.
But Christ offers a worldview, a whole different way of life that changes the meaning of what you're doing.
Yes.
I think.
And just before this, I mean, everyone, the author has addressed people in 2:16 as free persons, but who are slaves of God. So, I mean, there's a lot of playing.
I love that paradox.
Yeah. There is a sense that all of us are slaves of God, even while we might be stuck in awful human situations. And I think there the sense of hope in something greater and bigger and more
and
ultimate.
Slavery to God is a blessing.
Yes, even though we don't perhaps hear it like that with our modern ears.
And then there's a whole issue of us being slaves to other small g gods.
Yes, there is that too. We're, of course, in the realm of household codes here. Do we need to say anything about that, Mike? Do you want?
Yeah, well, one of the questions has always been how applicable are the household codes to today? Because we don't have a thing where you have like a family patriarch with, you know, wife who basically runs the house, slaves, freedmen, children, dependents, and very hanger-oners. Our households tend to be a lot different from that. And there can be some really, you know, cheesy and I think unhelpful applications of the household codes. Mm. You know, things like, well, you know, we don't have slaves anymore, but, you know, basically treat your employees, you know, slaves, employees, basically the same thing.
I
mean, the analogy I give to my students is, imagine if we wanted to create a kind of evangelical Anglican powerhouse to facilitate an alliance between the House of Bird and the House of Rosner, Brian Rosner being my boss, that we arranged for my daughter Alyssa to marry his son Toby, and we had to bring them together to seal this alliance, which would become the basis for us to become the most powerful, you know, Anglican family Melbourne or something.
I feel
like
you've
that.
Given this too much thought.
I know. I feel like you've heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, well, I did run it by Alyssa, and she was, how can I say, disinclined to acquiesce to my suggestion.
Yeah, right, yes.
Good on her.
Not in the ancient world, she has a choice about that too.
Yeah, well, exactly. So there are some huge cultural chasms that you have to look at. Now, you could take away the point that within your respective, you know, family setup, whatever that is, you know, you should show due respect for people, for parents, for siblings, grandparents, whatever it is. You know, the families come in all shapes and sizes. But we don't normally think of family now in kind of an extended group with a particular hierarchy.
Yep.
So I would be very cautious against the direct application of that. Basically, what Peter is doing, and Paul does this, I think, in his own letters as well, is take what is a fairly well-known structure, which is regarded as the basis for running a healthy and reputable household, and sort of attempts to sort of Christianize it or add some Christian values to it, hence the remarks about mutual submission in places like Ephesians 5, commandments not to exasperate children, not to be harsh with slaves, that type of a thing. Again, we could wish for a little bit more William Wilberforce here, but, you know, working within the worldview and the expectations and the relationships that they have at that time.
My understanding is in this passage of Peter, though, it is significant that slaves and masters, that relationship is mentioned first, because he goes on only goes on chapter 3 about wives and husbands, and in terms of a hierarchy, you would expect
perhaps to start there.
So I feel like there is a radical prioritizing of the slaves, perhaps because the community are resident aliens. I mean, they have no power, and that the identity as a slave is most similar to their predicament of powerlessness.
I think that could be right. And Eugene Boring, in his commentary, does point out that we have examples in Aristotle and Philo and Josephus of these what we're calling household codes, these sort of agreed upon sets of ethics of what orders society. And there's lots of scholarship out there about how Paul and other New Testament writers have softened it in places, like you've just said, Mike, with the mutuality and sort of made some in places some fairly radical changes, I think. But Eugene Boring points out this is the only one that actually addresses slaves. So even though we hear it as so deeply problematic to kind of tell slaves to keep being slaves, he's addressing slaves as worthy humans, humans worthy of hearing the gospel.
Children of God.
Yeah.
As children of God.
Yeah. Definitely.
I wonder too, one of the challenges for me, and as we move into our last few minutes here in terms of how we preach this and what we do with texts like this, I wonder too, Peter offers us a bit of an ethic of a kind of a don't rock the boat, be a good citizen. I don't mean that facetiously, but I think part of what he's trying to do is that it's almost an apologetic. Christians must be even more moral. Don't retaliate, don't return evil for evil. You'll show by your endurance in suffering, your gentleness, your love. This is how you'll kind of show
the gospel.
The gospel. You'll live out Christ's calling. Mm. And I wonder, you know, in our context, what that might look like. Because I think too easily Christianity has actually become about being a good citizen in ways that we might want to disrupt. Yeah. But how do we embody in the modern age this kind of suffering attitude of Christ, but without going down that really problematic track of telling everyone you just put up with anything? This is not about being passive or,
Yeah, for me, the biggest question these texts throw up is, when do you not rock the boat, live within the system, try keep your head down, be the grey man, as we would say, and when do you work for to try bring the whole system down?
Yes, because it's unjust.
Because it's inherently unjust, it's wicked, it's perverse, it's exploitive, it serves a very particular minority. So when do you live within the system and make do as best you can and endure? And when do you kind of, sow the seeds of revolution of some type? And I think Christians had to walk the balance between wanting to do a bit of both. I mean, Christians were the ones who were, to use the language of Acts, turning the world upside down. Claiming that there is a king other than Caesar. But they try to show that they're not a direct military riotous threat, that they're not anarchists who just want to burn everything down, that they kind of want to resurrect human life within its current places. That they don't want to burn everything down. They want to see rather a new type of life sprout, where there is only death, decay, and injustice in the old place. Yeah. And I mean, and in one level, I mean, I find it very interesting how Peter moves seamlessly from this wonderful statement about the atonement in verse 24. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross. But then you've got to note the purpose of that. And the purpose of the atonement comes down to moral transformation, you know, so that we might die to sin and live for righteousness, and by his wounds you've been healed. And that applies to both the individual, but also I think to the communities. Yep. They are to live for righteousness, and they're to be the means of healing in their own community. So that's where he ends up after this talk of slavery and this, you know, wonderful statement of atonement and Christ's example. He wants Christians to be exemplars and instruments for moral transformation, both individually, collectively, and I think in their wider context.
Thank you. That's looped us around the last couple of weeks, and we're going to see it again next week too. One of the themes in Peter is holiness. Here the language is righteousness, but it begs that ongoing question of what does a holy life look like in whatever our context is.
Yeah, and the reality is that it will challenge and affront a lot of the forces around us.
Yeah.
What we do, you know, just following that radical life will be challenging. It will produce hostility.
Yeah.
Although in our culture, really, apathy is really more the problem, but that's perhaps a conversation for another podcast.
Another whole day on that.
Indeed.
I'm going to throw to you for last words in a moment, but you're all listening to By the Well with special guest Mike Bird. This podcast is brought to you by the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Any last words as we think, of our listeners and the current world, dealing with a global pandemic that looks like very different kinds of suffering for people, whatever their situations are?
Oh yeah, I mean you can get all sorts of sufferings at the current time. I know my extrovert wife is definitely craving some company other than myself and our children. We get people who haven't seen grandkids for a long time, and there's obviously sort of higher domestic violence risks. So yeah. I think in trying to endure this time is going to look different for a lot of different people. I guess for me the big takeaway is. Christ is our shepherd who has laid down his life for us, and by his wounds we are healed. And I guess in whatever context you are in this crazy, confounded COVID-19 world, that's something we can take solace from, that Christ remains the shepherd and overseer of our souls.
Well, we're going to leave it there today. Thank you for listening.
This podcast has been made with the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Thanks for listening.